Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The 2019 Netflix miniseries When They See Us tells the horror story of the criminal justice system in the 1989 case of the Central Park Five. The critically acclaimed series garnered 11 Emmy nominations and one for Best Leading Actor in a Limited Series and Outstanding Casting for a Limited Series. The story reflects a major shift in how television tells black stories with black leads and by showcasing dramatic, socially conscious themes. The Best Leading Actor winner, Gerald Jerome, played the role of Corey Wise during a courtroom scene.
What does the statement say? Read the statement. What does the statement say? Read what the sentence says.
I can't read well. I can't read very well.
Can you try to read it?
I said I can't read very well.
Just read what the sentence says.
What's wrong with this woman? I said I can't read well. She pushing on me.
Can you read any of the words?
How? Maybe.
David Moody is the author of the 2016 book, The Complexity and Progression of Black Representation in Film and Television. Welcome to the show, David Moody.
Thank you.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans has worked 20 years in the business as a media analyst and contributor for MSNBC and NBC. He is the author of the 2012 book, Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. Welcome, Eric Deggans.
Thank you, but you don't have to tell people how old I am.
Well, I remember when you joined, so how about that? And also, I did not realize you were the first ever TV critic for NPR.
Yeah, exactly.
Which just goes to show that they figured out that television plays a really big role in our society. So When They See Us won for its casting, but the story is what made it stand out, right, Eric?
Yeah, and also what made it stand out is we're seeing a lot of TV projects, both docuseries and scripted series, that are about people from marginalized communities retelling stories from their point of view and providing an additional perspective on what happened. So what's remarkable about When They See Us is that it's very much from the perspective of the five men, they were boys when it happened, who were coerced into falsely confessing to raping a woman in Central Park during a melee many years ago and served time in prison for it, and then later were exonerated. So everything in the limited series is told from their point of view. And we've seen this also in docuseries like Leaving Neverland, for example, where two men come forward and tell their stories, their claims about being molested by Michael Jackson, and it's almost completely from their point of view and their family's point of view. And I think we're just now at a point we feel differently about policing. We feel differently about equality in society. We feel differently about how women are treated in society, thanks to the Me Too movement. So we feel so much differently about those things now that it's rich material for TV makers to go back and revisit things that happened 20, 25, 30 years ago when our mainstream pop culture wasn't as enlightened and sort of tell those stories from a different point of view.
What do you think, David Moody?
Yeah, I would agree with the points that Eric just brought up. I want to say something, too, because this kind of reflects upon my thinking when I go back and I look at the 50s and the 60s. Mm-hmm. Diane Carroll, who passed last week, and Julia, and in terms of her television show that she had done and how she was portrayed, kind of set the groundwork for a lot of things that I think we see today. But, yeah, there's a difference. But if you were to sit with my 92-year-old mother, who does not have a subscription or subscribe to Netflix, she would sit down and reflect back on Beulah and Amos and Andy and the Nat King Cole show and of course, Diane Carroll and Julia, which I love too as well, and she did and my dad did. Mm-hmm. And for her, in terms of images and how we as black people have been depicted through the years, still resonates with her even to this day. So,
you know, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I want to talk about Diane Carroll, the legendary actress. She died last week. She starred in the groundbreaking Julia, which in 1968 was the first show to feature a black lead in a non-stereotypical role. Here's a clip of Diane Carroll talking about Julia about 10 years ago.
We were saying to the country, we're going to present a very upper-middle-class black woman raising her child, and her major concentration will not be about suffering in the ghetto. And we don't know if you're going to buy it, but this is what we're going to do. Take a different point of view about blacks in the United States.
There is, I grew up with Julia. I loved it. But as I look back on it, I have to say, I didn't think about it when we were preparing this show, Eric Deggans. I kind of forgot about it. And then lo and behold, you know, Diane Carroll dies. And it's like, oh, my gosh, how could I forget Julia? What do you think the imprint of that program back in 1968? This is before Good Times, before the Jeffersons, any of that. What's the influence of that?
Well, you know, it's a milestone in the ongoing evolution of how black people were depicted on television. I would point out that she wasn't the first black woman to star in a series. That there was a show called Beulah in the 50s, starring a black woman who played a maid, and she wasn't the first black person to be a lead in a show because non-stereotypical role because Bill Cosby was co-lead of I Spy.
That's right.
Which was a few years earlier. Mm-hmm. But she was the first black woman to star in a TV show. She's the sole lead, and it's a non-stereotypical role.
Well, and Let me
finish my thought real quick, which is that at that time, what you had was these producers who were trying to create opportunities for black performers that they felt deserved it. So Sheldon Leonard created I Spy. Same thing happened with Diane Carroll showcased in Julia. And as good as that show was, Julia and her son were isolated. We rarely saw other black people on that show. She was surrounded by white characters. And so, you know, in the 50s, you have a show that's very stereotypical. In the 60s, you have these black people that I call super Negroes who are like ultra exemplars of humanity. Like, they're not allowed to have flaws. They have to be super intelligent, super moral. They can't really be that human because they have to be that good just to stand next to white characters in the mores of the times. And then we get to the 70s where we get more realistic characters in Good Times. And then we get to the 90s and we get the Cosby Show. So there's an evolution, and in these milestones, you know, Julia was an important part.
Yeah. David Moody?
Yeah, Eric, I agree with you. I think the argument that has, and you're right, in her case, that character, Julia, non-stereotypical, I think that's the argument that has been made versus the Beulahs of the world, if you will. One other thing, though, that I have reflected upon and looked at in conversations with former colleagues that I worked in television in the industry is the fact that the character Julia, at the time that it was on television, roughly from 68 to 71, is also a period in terms of which we find ourselves making our way toward the end of the civil rights movement. And there has been conversation pertaining that this issue of assimilation, her character, how that played out while the movement was somewhat playing itself out at the same time. The other argument can be made for the character too as well is that there is no father image that was present in the show. And Eric, you're right. There are very few, if any, other black characters that we see at all. But it was a single mom raising her child, and it now piggybacks and plays off this issue of the whole black family structure, single mother. We know the argument was made with, obviously, Esther Rolle in terms of Good Times originally because they wanted her to be a single mom. She said, you know what, I'm not doing that. You got to give me a husband. And that's how John Amos kind of came into the picture. So we have a lot of those factors, I think, that are playing out, too, as well, as we look at, you know, this topic of the evolution of black television.
Yeah, and at least they were nice enough. Well, nice enough, I don't know if that's the word, but at least on Julia, she was a single mother because her husband was killed in Vietnam.
Right.
Yes, yes.
Not because he left the family.
There was a backstory on that.
Yeah, there was a backstory on that, but of course, obviously, he wasn't there.
And then John Amos, you know, became a beloved character on Good Times. He was well-liked.
Oh, yeah, and, you know, as somebody who grew up in a household where I didn't have my father readily available, Good Times was important because I could see a family that was somewhat like my own. I grew up in Gary, Indiana. I'm not too far away from Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Being able to see a family that, you know, had the same material challenges that my family had in the same kind of neighborhood that I was growing up in, but the father's in the house and he cares for his kids and he's working hard and they're all trying to survive together, that was an important example for me to see and something that I actually, you know, kind of wished I had in my own life at that point.
The bottom line is Hollywood's a business. The television industry is a business. And I'm wondering, there were some people that were so troubled. They're telling this other story, these other stories, these other points of view. David Moody, is there bank in that at this point now that there wasn't 10 or 15, even 10 or maybe even 5 years ago?
Well, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, you raise an interesting point. It is a business. And, you know, you're in it to make money. I mean, we're, you know, on the one hand, we're discussing issues pertaining to images and how African Americans have been depicted, you know, going back to the early days, obviously, of television. I would say there's a bigger argument behind the scenes. And this speaks to, again, some of the arguments that John Amos was raising is who is producing. We know Shonda Rhimes writing, producing, love her. She's done some nice work. But my background is at the local television level. And one of the concerns I even have today is who are the people behind the scenes?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see many of them in terms of African-American that are serving in positions as general managers, general sales managers, presidents, running, calling shots. We see more images in front of the camera, and that's great. That's wonderful. But who's behind the scenes and who's making some of these decisions that's putting some of this stuff out here? There's been progression. I think obviously Eric would agree with me on that. I just mentioned Shonda Rhimes'
mm-hmm.
names. We know the producer of Black-ish. But how far, I guess, have we really come to this point?
That's a good point. You know, Eric Duggins?
I could actually speak to that. Mm-hmm. So one thing that I would say is that we have to sort of realize that all of us have been raised in this society that socializes us to elevate white culture over the culture of non-white people. So that's constantly a factor in these discussions about why something happens or why it doesn't happen in media. So there have been economic arguments made for the lack of diversity in television in the past, but I think that a lot of times they were used to disguise oppression and prejudice, and they were used in ways that in a lot of ways didn't even make sense. You know, like I remember interviewing some of the people who were the core cast members of Roots when that miniseries debuted in the 70s. It was a television event. It was a phenomenon. It was phenomenally successful and did really well in the Emmys and started a form of television that we began to call the miniseries. And a lot of the black actors on Roots didn't get work off of that show. like LeVar Burton was one of the few black stars of that show that actually got more work because his profile was elevated through Roots. You know, I think it was Leslie Uggams that told me, you know, she didn't work for like 2 years after that. So, you know, when you have something that popular that makes that impact and then the main actors that are involved with it can't get work afterwards, that is not an economic decision, right? So so that's part of what's going on. I think right now what's at hand is that what is bankable now, what is desired now by the TV networks and also by the audience is authentic stories from marginalized people, right? So it's harder to create those authentic stories if the main writer or the main producer is white.
Mm-hmm.
So now we have Shonda Rhimes stepping forward. Now we have Kenya Barris, who created Black-ish and Mixed-ish,
yes.
and Brown-ish. Now we have Donald Glover, who created Atlanta. Mm-hmm. We have Ray, who created Insecure. We have Diallo Riddle and Bashir Salahuddin, who created Sherman Showcase and Southside, two shows that aired on Comedy Central and IFC. There's a lot of black creators now and non-white creators that are getting a chance to create the shows that were in their head all the time because the marketplace is now ready for that. But I would argue the marketplace has been ready for that for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of us had to sort of beat down this resistance that, you know, people were using these economic terms to justify something that really wasn't about economy. It was much more about prejudice and being hesitant to feature non-white voices.
More about you don't look like me. We are going to continue our conversation. That's Eric Deggans. He's the NPR TV critic, media analyst, and author of the book Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. Also with us, David Moody. He's an adjunct professor at Lake Erie College and author of the book The Complexity and Progression of Black Representation in Film and Television. What do you think out there? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Mike Thompson.
And I'm Steve Brown, and we are the hosts of Snollygoster, WOSU's podcast all about politics in Ohio.
Each week, we chat about what the shrewd politicians at the State House are up to and how national politics affects us here at home.
Find out why listeners have called us a weekly must-listen. For a lighthearted yet in-depth look at Ohio politics, subscribe to Snollygoster wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. That's the theme song from Good Times. It was a groundbreaking sitcom in the 1970s that was about people of color, but also managed and produced by whites. We're talking about how black-led television has emerged from the typecasting of earlier generations. Still with us, NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, author of the 2012 book Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation, and also Dave Moody. He's the author of The Complexity and Progression of Black Representation in Film and Television. Let's talk about Good Times, the Jeffersons. I remember Sanford and Son, which was a spinoff from the Archie Bunker show. But Eric Deggans, why did we like them so much? They weren't run by people of color, but they touched a note.
They did. Actually, Sanford and Son was not a spinoff of All in the Family. Good Times was technically a spinoff of All in the Family because Florida Evans,
yes.
Esther Rolle's character,
oh.
was lead of the Bonkers. And the Jeffersons was also split off because the Jeffersons were their neighbors.
I thought Sanford's son was a friend of...
No.
Okay, of Meathead. Okay, sorry.
I don't think
Me bad.
So.
Okay.
But it's interesting. We have this moment, and I think it starts with Good Times, where we have sitcoms that are centered on black characters that are living in poverty. And it's an interesting moment because it is a reality that a lot of black folks live now and were living then, but it became a genre unto itself. And I call it in my book, I think I called it the ghetto com.
Mm.
And it was Good Times. This was Sanford and Son. This was What's Happening, if you remember that
yep.
show.
Yes, yes.
And the good things about those shows is that it was depicting a reality that a lot of black folks were living at the time. And as I said, you know, I saw Good Times and I saw myself, my family in it. Mm-hmm. But it also minimized the effects of poverty. And I think it created a sense that black people weren't suffering all that much living in these places. And because they were all mostly written by white people, there were a few black writers here and there that worked on some of these shows. You know, you didn't necessarily get the sense that you were feeling a fully authentic voice coming through. Now, I think the actors tried to have some effect on the storylines and how the characters evolved to try to make them as authentic as they can make them. But ultimately, you know, to the point that was made earlier, you know, black people didn't control those shows. And so they had a limited amount of impact that they could have. And the Jeffersons was an interesting show because it featured a black family, but they weren't poor. Mm-hmm. And that was something that was really unusual for the time. And I think that's another reason why that show really sticks out in people's minds.
What do you think, David Moody?
Yeah, and when we look at Sanford and Son, in particular when I think of Red Fox, and I have to go back to Mom and Dad and even my grandmother who was living at the time, I think the fact that they were familiar with his work as a stand-up comic, you know, crossover into his work in terms of what he did on television. I was always a big fan of Sanford and Son. I liked the relationship between father and dad. At least to me, I had a close relationship with my pop. That meant a lot to me to see the going-ons in terms of what took place as far as the family was concerned. And quite frankly, Fred was a businessman. He sold junk for a living. But he was a businessman, and he made ends meet. And when you look at that period from 72 to 75, for many of us, that was still a critical thing. I think that also parlays into when we think about Good Times, on the flip side of that, is the fact that you did have some struggles as far as the family was concerned, trying to make ends meet. So that also resonated with Black America, too, as well. Jeffersons, okay, from 75 to 1985. Now we're looking at a man who, quite frankly, is a capitalist. But he's worked his way up from one point, from point A to point B, and he's been successful at that. So you kind of have three different layers, if you will, that's taking place here that, at least as far as Black America was concerned, it gave us something to identify with.
Some refer to the likes of Good Times and the Jeffersons as examples of blaxploitation. Does that critique hold up, Eric Duggins?
Well, I don't know quite what they mean by that. I mean, if you're talking about the classic term blaxploitation, that refers to a type of film that emerged in the 1970s.
Yes,
that set black characters as heroes in these sort of action-oriented
cops and robbers kind of thing. Yeah.
Like, well, the storylines, quite frankly. Yeah, dealt with Kill Whitey, I'm putting it out there. I mean,
Kill Whitey's system, you know.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
The thing about Shaft was that he was a guy who would get justice for black people because the typical routes of the police and law enforcement could not deliver it, and that was often the theme in blaxploitation, movies. So I don't see that parallel there. I don't think that term fits with these. You know, I did want to note that one reason why you might have thought that Sanford and Son and All in the Family were connected is that Sanford and Son and All in the Family were both adapted from British sitcoms by Norman Lear and his partner Bud Yorkin. And Norman Lear isn't really talked about when it comes to Sanford and Son. I think his participation in that show isn't as widely known. I don't think he was necessarily credited when it came out, but his partner Bud Yorkin was, I think, the lead producer on Sanford and Son, and that was based on a British sitcom called Steptoe and Son. They're not spinoffs, but they were created by the same guys working at the same company. And both developed from British sitcoms.
And there was the same, and I was thinking about that. What gave me that impression? I guess I should check my facts, but there was a feeling and ambiance about both of them too.
Yeah, I think, you know, when Sanford and Son was popular, I think Fred Sanford was presented as the black answer to Archie Bunker.
Yeah.
Because he had problems with white people.
Yeah.
Archie Bunker had problems with people of color. And so I think those two, and you know, Sanford and Son was on NBC, and All in the Family was on CBS. So,
right.
You know, maybe there was a little bit of that going on.
Yeah, but I think Eric raises a good point, especially to this issue of bigotry, if you will, when we look at Archie Bunker and we look at Fred Sanford, and you know, and he said what he felt. He said what was on his mind. So he didn't mix words, which was kind of a neat thing, again, considering the time in terms of when these shows played.
It was just amazing to see somebody like Red Fox, who was known as being a nightclub comedian who was really risque. Finding huge stardom in a mainstream sitcom. I mean, it would have been like if Richard Pryor was able to pull it.
Yes.
When I was a kid, I used to listen to Red Fox albums in my room with the volume turned down, so, you know, my mom couldn't hear.
Right.
And me and my friends would be listening to it and laughing. And then that guy is the star of one of NBC's biggest sitcoms. It was really kind of interesting. And white America didn't really have any idea. Like where he came from.
I didn't. I was watching The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, and she was listening to his albums turned down in her bedroom.
Again, that speaks to my mom and dad and my grandmother. So they knew where he came from.
They knew, exactly. They knew.
This era that we've been talking about, Good Times in the Jeffersons, was followed by a boom in black sitcoms, The Cosby Show, Martin, and The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, to name just a few. And here's a well-known clip from The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
I'm sorry. If there was something that I could
do. Hey, you know what? You ain't got to do nothing, Uncle Phil. Hey, you know, ain't like I'm still 5 years old, you know? Ain't like I'm going to be sitting up every night asking my mom, when's daddy coming home, you know? Who needs him? Hey, he wasn't there to teach me how to shoot my first basket, but I learned, didn't I? Hey, I got pretty damn good at it, too, didn't I,
yeah,
Uncle Phil?
You did.
Got through my first day without him, right? Mm. I learned how to drive. I learned how to shave. I learned how to fight without him. I had 14 great birthdays without him. He never even sent me a damn card. To hell with him! I need him then, and I don't need him now.
Still an amazing scene, even all these years later. Eric Deggans, Will Smith, of course, you know, quite great talent, but that was something to do that back then.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting. So the Cosby Show, you know, it's sad what's come to light about Bill Cosby since then.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, it was a tremendous success for NBC. And the success of that show, I think, allowed and encouraged NBC and other networks to try shows that might star, other talented black performers. So we got the spinoff, A Different World, where a character from The Cosby Show, went to college. In the same way that Grown-ish is a spinoff of Black-ish.
Mm-hmm.
And The Fresh Prince came along, about 6 years after The Cosby Show debuted. They gave Will Smith a sitcom, and I think maybe there was a sense, you know, here's a talented young guy, you know, maybe we can create a sitcom that will capture younger viewers in the way that The Cosby Show is a favorite of, you know, everyone. And it was interesting because, NBC didn't really follow through with that example. You know, again, I talk about how economics can be distorted by prejudice. Once Friends becomes a success and Seinfeld becomes a success, and Frasier becomes a success, and Mad About You becomes a success. These are all shows that began to air on Thursdays when The Cosby Show aired. Once The Cosby Show and A Different World are off the air, Thursday nights becomes this haven of shows centered on white characters set in urban areas where there should be more diversity, but mm-hmm. they don't show it. And it is interesting how, once The Cosby Show and A Different World kind of leave the air, You get this must-see TV night that is filled with all these shows that don't that have little or no diversity in their cast, and that encourages Fox to develop sitcoms that star black casts and Latino actors. So you get, I mean, Living Single was earlier than Friends, but you get Martin, you get In Living Color, you get New York Undercover. You get all of these sitcoms and dramas that star non-white characters as counter-programming to the very white must-see TV, you know, legions that, well, that built Thursday night.
What do you make of the fact that the networks turn their back on the likes of The Cosby Show and Fresh Prince of Bel-Air? They were so successful. Why, David Moody, what do you think about that?
I know that's a great question. I mean, because when you think of The Cosby Show, and at least for me, and you look at the storylines and the character roles and how they depicted a strong black nuclear family structure, mm-hmm. which quite frankly was probably the first for network television. I mean, you had a father who was a physician. The mom was a lawyer. The kids can go to NYU. They can do well. And again, the family lived well economically, but you had a lot of family issues that were discussed throughout the storylines of the show. And it's an interesting point because it's almost like we gravitated away from that. Mm-hmm. And I actually was working for one of the first Fox affiliates in the country at WOIO-TV in Cleveland, which, by the way, the station was constructed and founded by an African-American. And, you know, for us, at the station level at that time, and we're looking at shows like In Living Color and what the Wayne brothers were doing, mm-hmm. and the fact that Fox was kind of going out on the limb and doing these type of sketch comedies in primetime television, it was quite interesting for us too, you know, in terms of from a different dynamic. So I think that's a great question. Yeah, we moved away from that. We moved away from that look at the black family structure, you know, from an economic standpoint. It's a great question. I don't know. Some would say perhaps maybe Black-ish now is touching on that. I mean, you have a successful family there, mm-hmm. as far as the wife is concerned. You know, again, physician, the dad who is working at an ad agency and has done well for himself, the children, educated, the intellect is there. So perhaps maybe it has come back in its own way. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. I think Kenya Barris has been quite open about how the path of Black-ish and Grown-ish were inspired by Cosby, and how the success of The Cosby Show led to A Different World. So it's no coincidence that those sets of shows have so much in common.
Yeah. There was another show that was on, and Eric, maybe you can speak to this too, that I've had some conversations in the past, short-lived. I had had an opportunity to spend some time with Tim Reed, but a show called Frank's Place, sure. That was on the air from 1987 to 1988. Some would say that as far as the storyline is concerned and the writing, it was quite good.
Yeah, that was a show about a guy who owned a restaurant in New Orleans. And it was not only a show that featured a lot of characters of color, it was a show that talked about race in a very nuanced way that was unusual for TV shows of that time. And I think it was quite simply just ahead of its time. And that's
yes.
The reason why we talk about it now, is that it couldn't survive in the TV world of that time. And it never got great ratings. Critics talked about it, but viewers didn't really show up for it. Excuse me. One of the things that was interesting about Cosby, I remember talking to a TV executive who worked on that show with Bill Cosby, and one of the things the Cosby Show did is that it didn't often talk about you know, racial prejudice and stuff like that directly.
Mm-hmm.
Like because the show was almost always all black. Like, they never really delved very deeply into controversial stuff like that. It was always about sort of uplifting people and showing a strong black family by example. And, you know, there would be references, of course, to the way that black people get treated and stuff like that. But to have storylines fully centered the way Blackish does on, like, the use of the N-word or,
yes,
you know, the election of Trump or, you know, something like that. Like, they would never do that. Like Bill Cosby's whole strategy in doing the Cosby Show was to sort of talk obliquely about this stuff, because that's how he became successful, mm-hmm, as a black entertainer, by not challenging white people, but by, you know, influencing them in more subtle ways. Mm. You know, by presenting a character that's a great example, and then and making the argument for equality that way. You know, mm-hmm, here's a great father who's leading a great family. His wife is a lawyer. They're all very accomplished. The kids are going to college. Here's the argument for equality, and I don't even have to say it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And so it's interesting. One of the other differences between then and now is that the marketplace wants shows that delve into these issues and that challenge people in a way that TV would not allow. Back when the Cosby Show was on and when Frank's place was on.
We have to say goodbye to David Moody, adjunct professor at Lake Erie College, author of the book The Complexity and Progression of Black Representation in Film and Television. David Moody, thank you so much for your time today. We will continue our conversation. We're going to bring in a local filmmaker who has thoughts about this as well. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about how black-led television has evolved from one-dimensional typecasting to shows such as Good Times, a story that was groundbreaking in its own right, but not led or produced by people of color, to the likes of award-winning limited series When They See Us in 2019. Still with us is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Joining us is Kristen Stewart. She's a local filmmaker and founder of the Columbus Black International Film Festival. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Kristen, what did you grow up watching on television?
I grew up watching Family Matters. I grew up watching Fresh Prince. I grew up watching Different World, Martin, Living Single, all the UPN shows, the Parkers, Girlfriends, Moesha, all those types of things.
Did it feel like you were their audience?
I did. I absolutely felt included. I felt like the topics had everything to do with what I was going through as a teenager, how I navigated the world, and me seeing that representation of as young black women on screen and young black men.
Yeah, I mean, was that a change, Eric Deggans? I mean, does it matter who the audience is? Yes.
Yeah, it always matters who the audience is. It also sort of matters, like, what the show's trying to say. Mm-hmm. Often, you know, and it's interesting because there were a lot of different kinds of shows mentioned that I think existed for different reasons. You know, some of these shows were sort of we had this weird phenomenon back then where Fox was just starting as a network, and then you had UPN come along, and then you had the WB come along as a network afterwards. You know, young people won't even know what I'm talking about, but these were smaller, newer networks, mm-hmm, and Fox established this pattern where you could target black viewers, especially in programming, because most of mainstream television didn't depict black people very well or mostly ignored us. If you featured a lot of shows with black casts, black people would watch, and you would get a quick number right away, and you would get a loyal audience that would stay with you. Mm-hmm. And so Fox did that. They had a loyal audience on Thursdays that helped them survive against NBC. And then when they got established as a network, surprise, surprise, those shows suddenly started to go away. Now, again, like I was saying, it doesn't make economic sense. You know, if there's a need for the show and people are watching it and you're making money, why would you stop doing it? But But I think they thought to be a quote unquote real network, they had to move beyond the programming that they originally featured to draw a quick audience so that they could get the network established. And so UPN did the same thing. And the WB also did the same thing. So you had these shows, the Steve Harvey Show, you had Moesha, you had the Jamie Foxx Show. You know, these sitcoms that people love now because they remember them nostalgically, but, you know, when they were being created, they didn't have much of a budget. They were created to draw a quick audience, and once the networks felt they had kind of established themselves, they started to jettison those shows as well.
You know, Kristen Stewart, you probably weren't aware of that at the time that that's what was happening when you were a kid, right? But as far as the diversity that you're seeing on the screen now, on the small screen, and aided by the likes of Black Panther and that kind of a thing, you can, it's undeniable. I mean, it's still in the top four, I think, ever. Did it? If you look back, did it play a role in your interest in getting into the filmmaking business?
It absolutely did, because I thought that we all had a seat at the table. Right. And then there's a spectrum of blackness that we've seen. Right. So we've seen like Different World. Right. So that kind of got me interested in going to college. And then we've seen Living Single, which had me interested like, oh, so this is what after Different World is going to look like. And then we've seen things like The Cosby's or The Fresh Prince when we've seen people from different socioeconomic classes. One show that I didn't mention, 101, was a show where they talked about, you know, a single father raising his daughter, and he was in sports entertainment. And so that kind of led to a different type of environment of blackness that I could also relate to coming from a single parent home. So I think there was pockets of all these different types of things that myself and my peers could relate to. And I think that diversity through blackness is kind of like what I thought was already happening because I've seen it in my everyday life.
A group of executives at Netflix created the Strong Black Lead Initiative, committing to showcase diverse stories by black people and for black people. Mm-hmm. Here's a clip from A Great Day in Hollywood. It was released by Netflix last year.
This is a new day, built from the ground, broken by legends. A day for our generation to see untold experiences of our blackness, representing a limitless range of identity, playing kings and queens of our neighborhoods, defeating larger-than-life forces, trying to flip our world upside down. We stand up on any stage and every screen. A day when black women are boldly the lead character, whether inmates or scholars. We're not a genre, because there's no one way to be black. We're writing while black, nuanced and complex, resilient and strong. This is not a moment. This is a movement.
You know, Eric Deggans, a couple things that jump out at me in that, the limitless range of identity, mm-hmm. and this is not a genre.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that Netflix would say that, right?
Mm-hmm.
They have created a landing page called with the named after that initiative. I'm forgetting exactly the word.
A Great Day in Hollywood?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. The Strong Black Lead, yeah.
Yeah, so they've created a landing page that you can go to where you can see all of these different products that they think kind of fit that banner. They have a Twitter page, and they have a young woman who interviews directors and producers and actors from these shows in a podcast, right? So they are marketing this framing of some of their material to people of color and people who are interested in this material in a lot of different ways. They're treating it like a genre.
Right. Kristen Stewart, I mean, if you have to say it's not a genre, then it's probably a genre, right?
Right. Right.
Well, they're treating it like a genre. But the thing that's interesting to me is that if you look at black folks especially, they watch TV more than white people watch TV per capita. And there's a lot of buying power in black households. Mm-hmm. And what we see in broadcast television and cable television especially is that because viewership of those platforms has dropped so much, they can't afford to take black viewers for granted anymore. So we are seeing TV shows that are created to cater to black audiences and particularly to cater to black women, because black women make a lot of the purchasing decisions in their households, right? So what rescued the Oprah Winfrey Network? Hmm. They started programming to black women. Mm-hmm. You see it on channels like WeTV. Okay. TV One exists because of black women. The older version of black-centered programming, black entertainment television is geared towards younger viewers, but TV One is very much about black women, so much so that they created another channel called Cleo TV that's specifically for black women. So it's interesting, once you know like how the economics of this works and how the viewership patterns work, you can see that they're figuring out all these different ways to market this programming to black audiences, because black audiences are a loyal and powerful audience. We will show up for good shows that feature black characters in a way that other ethnic groups will not. And so they know that there's a reward there if they create great programming that features black characters.
Which, bottom line, is all good for you, Kristen Stewart.
Right. Yeah, so even thinking about, you know, what he was saying about TV and how TV is kind of communal in the black household, especially when you're talking about that 1960s era when we start to see Julia, when we start to see Good Times, when we start to see 227 and Amen and those things, as they get into those time frames, it kind of becomes this communal kind of process, right? And then having that representation, and then you having matriarchs who are at the helm of those stories, which I think kind of you have to take cues from that to be able to make the shows that we have now, right? And then even when you're talking about the scripted TV, you kind of can't leave out the reality TVs, the reality TV of that. And I think VH1 has kind of taken some cues from Logo, which is MTV, and they've kind of used those things. So we have like Love and Hip Hop, we have, you know, The Black Ink, we have Growing Up, Hip Hop, all those types of shows. I think that kind of also balances out like all the scripted options that we have on top of what Netflix is saying that they're doing, right? And so they have, you know, Caleb McLaughlin, I think I'm saying his name right, who stars in Stranger Things, actually doing that Day in Hollywood video. And so it kind of puts us into perspective, right? Because he's not genre specific, but it does kind of put us in a position of saying that, like, again, like I was saying, like, we have a seat at the table, right? Whether we're in the writing room, when we see shows like Insecure, when we see shows like Atlanta, when we see Black Ladies Sketch Show, when we see those types of things. But it also puts us at the table, like, when we're at home and we can all see ourselves diversely as black culture in America.
Do you, I mean, we've been talking, Eric Deggans, off and on throughout the hour about the reversals from time to time.
Yeah.
Are we beyond the reversals now?
I don't think we'll ever be beyond the reversals.
That's like saying we're not a racist society anymore because we elected a...
Exactly,
yeah, right, right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I thought we were beyond the reversals when we elected Barack Obama and
right.
Donald Trump. So I think the biggest danger we face now is in underestimating the possibility of a backlash against all this wonderful multi-ethnic programming.
Absolutely.
That we have. There's so many great shows created by people of color on television right now. It's somebody on Twitter was being a little cynical about diversity in television, and I just wrote a quick post where I listed all the shows that I could think of that were created by and starring people of color.
Mm-hmm.
And I listed, like, I don't know, 13 shows before. I mean, right off the top of my
mm-hmm.
head. I've been covering television since 1997. I've never seen it like this,
mm-hmm.
but we can never lose sight of the fact that there can be a backlash and that people can start convincing themselves that all these old stereotypes that they use to justify not featuring people of color in shows, oh, you know, white people won't watch them, oh, those shows won't do well overseas, oh, advertisers mm-hmm. won't pay money for them.
Mm-hmm.
All of this nonsense that shows like Scandal and Empire and The Cosby Show disproved time and time again. We may have to make that argument again once the backlash comes back.
Eric Deggans, thanks so much for joining us. Eric Deggans is NPR TV critic, media analyst, author of the book Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. And Kristen Stewart, thanks for joining us. I really appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me today.
Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.